Hebrews chapter 4, beginning at verse 14. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has gone through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet was without sin. Let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Every high priest is selected from among men and is appointed to represent them in matters related to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He is able to deal gently with those who are ignorant and are going astray, since he himself is subject to weakness. This is why he has to offer sacrifices for his own sins, as well as for the sins of the people. No one takes this honour upon himself. He must be called by God, just as Aaron was. So Christ also did not take upon himself the glory of becoming a high priest. But God said to him, "You are my son. Today I have become your father." And he says in another place, "You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek." During the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with loud cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. Although he was a son, he learned obedience from what he suffered. And once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him, and was designated by God to be high priest in the order of Melchizedek.
Thank you, Molly. So, what or who do you turn to if you want something to be done well? Let's say you want to have an extension built on your house. So who would you go and ask? Probably a teacher? No. I know, an artist. You know, they can do lovely... No, perhaps not. A doctor? Now, they have a good training. Would that be the first person you go and ask? No, probably not. I think you probably go to either an architect or a builder, or possibly even a banker. What about if you wanted to get a new car? Who would you go and see then? You know, to get all the info. A furniture salesman might be a good idea. They know about, you know, constructing kits, don't they? IKEA. Or perhaps a Formula One driver. They would be able to help you find the right car. Well, a fast car, anyway. What about the winner of the Tour de France? Possibly wrong number of wheels. Yeah. No, obviously in both those cases, you'd probably go to an expert in that field, wouldn't you? I mean, that seems to be the obvious thing to do. So why then would you go to see a priest? Perhaps to help you choose which saint to pray to? To help you with an addiction? Coach you on how to read a Bible passage aloud. We don't need that in this church. Well, possibly. But the main job, surely, of a priest would be to help you get in touch with God in some way or other. Now, our series in the mornings on Samuel has shown us what happened in the country of Israel when priests were not functioning properly. And you remember the story of the priests, the sons of Eli, who, when people came to bring sacrifices for worship, to worship God, They said, give us that meat, right? We'll have a bit, take that bit off now, we'll keep that for ourselves. Or they put it in the pot and then get their three-pronged fork, and before it even started cooking properly, they go in and fish something out. Ah, that will be good for us. Instead of doing what they should have done, namely, the best parts go to God. That's the whole point of the sacrifice. So people got put off going to see the priests because they weren't doing their job. At the time of the writing of the letter to the Hebrews, many Jewish Christians had tasted the new Christian life, but they were having slight doubts. Well, we quite like the ritual business of our faith, and we like, you know, going to see a priest, you know, someone you can actually see and doing things. Perhaps it might be a good idea to go back and to immerse ourselves in that again. And so the writer wants to dissuade them. So in this passage that Molly read to us, we come on to this idea of the priest, the Old Testament priest. Now, what do we know about the Old Testament priests? Well, in Exodus chapter 28, and certainly in our house group, we've been looking at that recently, Moses is told by God about the first priests who are going to be serving in the mobile temple, if I can call it that, the tent of meeting, or the tabernacle, it's called, which God gives instructions as to how it should be constructed in very great detail. All the different colours to be used, the different threads to be used, the boards to be used, the silver to be used, the gold to be used, the bronze to be used, how you put your boards together to get the outside, how you put your four layers of skins on the top to keep it, you know, dry, what should be made to be put in it, and how it, absolutely everything, every to the last detail. And then it needed the priests. And of course, the first person to be chosen to be number one man, the chief priest, the high priest, the top job, was Aaron, Moses' brother. And he's got to wear special clothes. Don't you think that's rather different from the priests we have today, in their black, possibly with a bit of white? That's the high priest in his garb. And, you know, it's quite symbolic what he wears. Did you know, for example, that before he's able to put on these clothes, he has to be washed publicly? So first thing he does, he goes into the courtyard outside the tent of meeting, and he's scrubbed. That's the first thing. And then he's dressed. And what does he wear? Well, he's got a white tunic, that's his sort of undergarment, really. And then he's got a blue robe on top of that, and the blue robe is very expensive to make it blue, because they used a shellfish. Well, you don't get many shellfish in the wilderness. So actually making, they must have had a store of them, to make the dye for the blue was quite tricky. Then he's got his ephod, which is that sort of little, what can I call it? Not apron type thing, you can see, which is very, very colourful and vibrant. That's his ephod. Then he's got a sash, which is similar, around his waist. He's got a turban on, and on the turban, can you just see, it's got a gold plate there, little strip of gold, which says Holy to the Lord on it. And then on his ephod, on the shoulders, you can just make out on either side of his shoulders, he's got a big stone, an onyx stone. On one side, he's got engraved six tribes of Israel, and on the other one, the other six tribes. So he's got the 12 tribes of Israel. And this is sort of symbolic that he has responsibility, overall responsibility for their spiritual health. And then on his breast piece here, on his ephod, he's got like a baggy pocket. And it's covered with 12 gemstones. Can you see the 12 gemstones there? Set out in four rows of three. And each of those has inscribed upon it the name of a tribe. So he's got the 12 tribes again here. On his shoulders it was for responsibility, but here it's over his heart. He is to love the nation of Israel. And that's symbolic of that. And also, inside, sort of, you pull it out and popped inside, are his Urim and his Thummim, which are the sort of ways that the priest, the high priest, was able to answer questions about God's leading. Should we go into battle today? Hang on a minute. And he pulled one out. Oh yes, it's the yes one. Or the other one would be the no one, of course. So that's how they used to use their sort of these two little things, the Urim and Thummim. So that's what he wore there. And at the bottom of his blue bit, you can see the little dangly bits. You've got bells and pomegranates there, which are all indicative of God's blessing and God's glory. So, you know, it's quite a get-up, really, isn't it, for the high priest to wear? What was his job? Well, his job was to take sacrifices, thank offerings, and various other things, but his biggest job was on one day of the year, the Day of Atonement. And on that day, he had to take a big bull, animal. It would be killed, put on the altar in the courtyard outside the tent of meeting. He would take some of the blood in a bowl for later on, but the main thing would be completely consumed in fire as a sacrifice to God. And do you know what the sacrifice was for? It was for his sin. Because the high priest was just like everyone else. A sinner. So he needed to have his sins atoned for first. And then he was able to do another sacrifice on behalf of the people. And then he trolled up to the tent itself. He'd pull back the curtain, or just ease the curtain back, nip inside, and then he'd make his way right through to the holiest place, which was this little tiny section right at the far end. And separating the holy place from the holiest place was this curtain. And on this curtain were pictures, beautifully hand-embroidered, of cherubim. And do you know what cherubim were used for? They're God's bouncers. Because at the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve were ejected, what did God do? He put cherubim at the entrance to the Garden of Eden with swords and fire and stuff, and they were to protect the entrance so that no one could go in, as it were, to God's place. So on this curtain to the holiest place, we also get the cherubim there, because they were there to frighten people off, basically. The only person allowed in once a year was the high priest. And he would go in with the blood and some incense. He'd burn the incense, which was representative of the prayers of God's people, and he'd splash the blood on the cover, which was on the ark. You know, the Ark of the Covenant, with which eventually had the tablets and some the tablets of the Ten Commandments and a little pot of manna inside it. On the top was this golden lid, and he poured the blood, or sprinkled the blood on that, and God would look down from his throne, see the blood, and atonement would be made for the sins of the people. And it was very, very quick. And you know, they were so worried about entering into the Holy of Holies, you know, anyone apart from the great high priest, of course, that they put a rope round his waist in case he died when he was inside, so they could pull him out. They wouldn't have to go in and get him, apparently. They were so frightened. And that was his main job, every year, once, to go into the... It was like a symbolic journey, if you like. He went from the east to the west in order to atone for sins. So, that's what he did. And that's the altar that was outside in the courtyard. And you can see that he's preparing to make a sacrifice there. Now, another thing about the priest was that it wasn't a general election. They didn't elect a priest, a high priest. That's Moses in the middle. On the left-hand side, you've got Aaron. And on the right-hand side, you've got Hur. And this was after they come out of Egypt and they had a battle with the Amalekites the first time. And if you remember, Moses has that God told Moses to hold his arms up, but after a certain time, you know, you can't keep your arms up, can you? They sort of sag. And so his relations held his arms up for him. But it was that Aaron, the one on the left, was the one that God chose to be high priest. And from then onwards, it was a matter of a hereditary thing. It was a descendant of Aaron, always, who was going to be high priest. It was God's choice. It wasn't man's choice. It's a bit like monarchy in this country, you know. Whoever's king or queen, whoever the oldest offspring is, will take over, you know, when they die. So it's a similar sort of thing, really. Now, having talked a little bit in here about what a priest does, the point of the writer of the Hebrews was to show that Jesus was in every way superior. Because, remember, what was his task? He was trying to dissuade people who'd been Jews, first of all, to go back to those ways. So, you know, how on earth was he going to get his message across? Well, I suppose we can say first and foremost is that in the situation of the priest in the Old Testament times, he was actually acting out something symbolic. The difference between him and Jesus was that Jesus actually did it. He wasn't acting anything out. He was actually living it. He didn't sacrifice any animals. No. Who did he sacrifice? Himself. And after he'd sacrificed himself, death on the cross, God exalted him to his right hand so that he is now in heaven itself. Seated there. God is there. Jesus is seated at his right hand. And we know what he's up to because we're told in the scriptures that he's praying for us. All the time. Every single one of us. He doesn't need gemstones on his breastpiece to remind him of who he's praying for. He knows each one of us. So, you know, he's praying for Maureen. He's praying for Byron. He's praying for Dave. He's praying for Di. He's praying for me. He's actually praying for us every day. He is a genuine go-between between man and God. The Old Testament high priest was never really satisfactory. So Jesus actually came into our situation and was clothed with humanity. We remember that at Christmas time, don't we? The incarnation. Jesus came and was born as a human being. And he joined us in our frailty and our weakness. In fact, he went through every form of temptation, just like we have. So he knows what it is to be tempted. He knows what it is to suffer. And the thing is, I mean, it's difficult to get your head around it, but his temptation was greater, far greater than anything we ever have to put up with. Because he was righteous. So he wasn't willing to give in to sin or give in to temptation. He felt everything so much more keenly than we do. Now, you may know from your own experience that if you resist temptation, you know, oh yes, well, let's say it's a bag of crisps. Okay, you've got the bag of crisps open in front of you. Oh, I can resist those crisps. Hang on, are those chicken flavour? Oh, I love chicken flavour. Oh, crisps. All right, how long have I been resisting? 1 minute. Oh dear. And the longer you resist, the more difficult it becomes, does it not? To resist. Jesus had a whole lifetime of not giving in to sin, not giving in to temptation. A whole lifetime of it. So think how difficult that must have been. How much the strain must have been on him. You know, do you remember that big storm when all the trees got decimated in this country? Well, my wife, who comes from Kent, seven oaks. How many are there left? Is it one? I can't remember. I think it's one. Well, in some of the forests, you know, virtually all the trees got blown down. So, which ones would you say felt the full force of the storm? Well, surely the ones that were still standing. They had it, you know, thrown at them. They didn't give up and fall over. No, they stood, you know, it was jolly hard for them. And in that sense, Jesus is the last man standing. He never gave in to sin or temptation. So, what did he do? Well, whilst he was on earth, apart from other things, he offered, as we're told in verse 7 here, prayers and pleadings. Notably, in the wilderness, when he was facing the temptations of Satan, but also particularly in the Garden of Gethsemane. We know that as he prayed, it was almost like sweat, blood drops came out. He was just so oppressive. And we know that he often got up early in the morning or late at night and went to pray. And so, you know, he sort of laid a trail that we try to follow. But the thing is, he was really in human form and he really suffered as a result. Because he resisted, even on the cross. He resisted. He resisted the devil. He resisted temptation. He wanted to follow his Father's will and do what his Father wanted him to do. So then, we can say, along with the writer here, that Jesus is the only person qualified as the great high priest. Did you know that no one in the scripture is called the great high priest? Except for Jesus. High priests came, high priests went. There might have been good ones, bad ones. But the great high priest is a label, a name dedicated to Jesus alone. He's the only one ever called great. He was the only one who was the Son of God. Completely unique. The only one who understands us through and through, as the writer says in verse 15. He's in a position to help us because of his death for us, which established our eternal salvation, and also because he's now seated on the throne in heaven and forevermore. He's the high priest forever. So he's able to sympathize with us. He knows our weaknesses. And he can be relied, as it says in verse 16 of chapter 4, to help us when we need it most. He is there with grace and mercy. So, for the readers of this, in 1st century AD, the choice was clear for those Jewish Christians. Either trusting in the very limited, temporary mediation of an earthly high priest once a year, or trusting in an eternal go-between who's always dispensing mercy and grace. Well, to me, that's a no-brainer, quite honestly. And I'm sure many of them felt that way as well. How wonderful it is for us that we live in the age of the new covenant, rather than the old covenant. We don't have to drop out of one system and embrace a new one. We're just brought into the new one almost straight away. We can, of course, learn from the symbolism of the old priesthood, but enjoy completely the benefits of what Jesus, our great high priest, has achieved for us straight away. But did you notice verse 9 in chapter 5? There's a key word: for all those who obey him. There is something we have to do. We can only claim his constant help if we constantly try to follow his word. We will, of course, fail, but we will, because of his grace and mercy, be picked up, dusted off, set on our feet again by this great high priest who will help us in our time of need. That's what it's all about. So we hope and pray that many of these Jewish Christians stayed firm in their new faith, didn't go back to their old ways, which were so inferior, because Christ is the superior high priest, the only one called great.